All right, how's everybody doing today? Good? All right, is that nobody? How's everybody doing today? Good? All right, good. The eighth commandment, you know what it is? Eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. That is the eighth commandment, that we are working our way through these 10 commandments, and we are on number 8. We have number 9 and number 10 to go, just in case you wouldn't have concluded that yourself, but that's what we've got in the weeks to come. But this week, the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. As with all the commands, there is a negative part of this command, the thou shalt not steal part. But behind that command is a very positive thing, and that is, namely, thou shalt be generous. There is a statement not just of what we are not supposed to do. Implied in that statement is something that we are supposed to be. We are supposed to be generous people, people whose lives are characterized not by taking, but people whose lives are characterized by giving. Okay, Ephesians 4:28 says it like this: let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. That's what the Apostle Paul said to the Ephesians, and it's brilliant in its own simple way, because Paul not only tells them quit stealing, he's saying, hey, you up until now you've been characterized as somebody who takes from others. But rather than just stopping stealing, I want you to get a job. And I want you to use that job to make money, and I want you to use that money to bless other people. He's talking about an entire transformation of life where you go from somebody who used to take, but now you're somebody who gives. Right? Tim Keller, a guy that I read a good bit, says it like this, and I think this is good. You have not stopped being a thief, biblically speaking, when you have stopped taking. You stop being a thief when you start giving. That's kind of the whole gist of what we're going after today, all right? Because most of you get the not stealing thing. Most of you get that. You understand that because you understand the rule of law. And you wouldn't be that immoral of people that you're just like, yeah, I steal and I don't feel bad about it. There may be a handful of you in here like that, but for the most part, most of you get the not stealing thing. But what this command really gets at is becoming the kind of person who's naturally generous, whose life is characterized by pouring itself out for others. One time Jesus made a statement. It goes like this. You probably heard it. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Here's my question as we start this morning. Do you really agree with that statement? Do you really agree with it? I don't mean agree with it here like, yes, I understand that Jesus said it and he's God, so he's right, and it's a platitude that I understand is part of the Christian faith. I mean, do you agree with it with your life? Could you say, yes, I truly believe, and my giving patterns reflect that it is more blessed to give. Right? That makes me happier to give than just to be one who receives all the time. That's how I feel. It's how my life shows it. If you look at my life, it's not characterized by begrudgingly giving. Right? It's characterized by pouring out. It's not giving so I won't feel guilty. It's pouring myself out for others. I love to do that. Do you believe that? And does your life show that you believe it? That's the question today, okay? As always, I want to welcome those of you that are at our other campuses that are joining us here this morning. You guys in North Raleigh on their third week, having an incredible run, and West Club and Cole Mill, as well as you guys in the Bay there. Here's what we're going to do today. Three different things as we approach this commandment. The first thing that we are going to do is I want to define for you what kinds of things the Scripture classifies as stealing. We're just going to do a quick survey of a lot of different places in the Bible and look at what the Bible talks about when it says stealing. Right, what is stealing? All right. Here's the second thing we're going to do is I'm going to try to explain to you why we steal. What's behind that action that we take? Then thirdly, I want to try to show you how we change from being people who are selfish and steal and cheat and exploit to being people who are generous and who love to give. And in order to look at how that change happens, we're going to take apart the story of a guy in the New Testament who probably is one of the best examples of a guy who goes from being a thief to being somebody who is unbelievably generous. Okay, so that's the scope of what we are going to cover this morning. And along the way this week, what I'll do is mix in humiliating personal stories that tell you how I break this commandment on a regular basis. Okay, all right, so first of all, what is stealing? What is stealing? That's our first question. Stealing, scripturally speaking, is simply taking anything that doesn't belong to you. I know that's not all that brilliant, but let's just acknowledge the simplicity of it. All right? Stealing is simply taking anything that does not belong to you. That includes, of course, the obvious. Things like breaking and entering, holding up a bank, shoving extra splendid packets into your purse at Starbucks, returning a dress or tie that you only had to wear once for a funeral or wedding, pirating on your neighbor's wireless internet signal, making it a double feature by sneaking into a second movie after you paid for your entry into one movie, filling up your water bottle with milk from the dining hall, you college students, okay? You know, things only really bad people do, the obvious kinds of stealing, that none of you all have ever done, ever, at any point in your life, okay? By the way, our executive pastor, David Thompson, had his car stolen out of his driveway this morning. So this is especially relevant for him, and I told him, I comforted him. I was like, yes, stealing the car out of your driveway is covered by this commandment. So, you know, don't worry, because it was wrong, okay? All right, so yeah, you can encourage him, because I think, I don't know, he should be, well, he'll be here in a little bit. But there's a lot of things, as soon as he catches a ride, there's a lot of things beyond jacking somebody's car that are stealing, all right? The book of James says that as an employer, you can steal from your employees by not paying them properly for the work they do for you. You know you can get away with it because they're not going to quit because the economy's so bad, they can't get another job, and so you just figure out ways to get more work out of them without paying them, so you're taking advantage of them, and James calls that stealing. As an employee, you can steal time from your employer by not really putting in a full effort in the hours you pay to work. You know, build yourself a little area under your desk where you can sleep and get away with it. Right? Surfing the internet all day or at work. I read an article this week that said that the average company with 50 employees could save $185,000 of man hours a year by putting on filters on the internet at work, because that's what people do during their time when they can get away with it. Right? Or you could just do, you know, a very poor job at what you do. It's a theft of quality. Jesus said in the Gospels that you can steal from the government by not properly reporting on your taxes. You can steal from creditors by figuring out a way to get out of paying your debts. You can download music illegally. Stealing doesn't always have to be monetary either. You can steal credit that belongs to other people. You can steal other people's homework if you're a student, which is probably not a good idea if you play for a UNC athletic team at the moment, okay? So just throw that out there. If this had come 2 weeks ago, maybe we wouldn't be in the mess we're in, all right? You can steal emotionally from people in relationships. 1 Corinthians 7:9 says that withholding sex in marriage is a type of stealing from your spouse because you are depriving your spouse of something that rightfully belongs to them. You can steal from your kids by staying late at work all the time. Guys, you can steal from a girl by leading her on emotionally when you have no intention of having a serious relationship with her. As in, you flirt with her and show her attention because you want to have sex with her, or even just because it's good for your ego to get that kind of attention from her. And you have no intentions of a serious relationship, but you just lead her on because you're getting something from her that otherwise she probably wouldn't give to you. You can steal an intimacy or a position in a relationship that belongs to somebody else. You know, the obvious implication of that is adultery, when you steal somebody else's spouse sexually. But a long time before it gets to that, you can just steal an intimacy from somebody else's spouse that never goes to the point of sex, but you're just taking that from them, and you're playing a role that you don't really belong to play. By the way, this is totally off subject. Can I just say this? Every once in a while, I get really disturbed hearing somebody who's married talk about being BFFs with somebody else who's of the opposite gender that's not their spouse. You know what I'm talking about? When I got married, I quit having BFFs that were girls. And a BFF, I mean best friend forever, not big fat friend, okay, in case you wonder what that meant. Veronica is my only BFF, all right? You know, because she and I emotionally, it's not like we don't have other relationships, but we belong to each other. Right? So you can steal things emotionally by getting involved in people's lives that you have no idea, no responsibility being involved in. You can steal from people by manipulating them through flattery. Absalom did that in the Bible. You know, you're really kind to somebody, you say things to them because you're trying to get them to give you something that they probably wouldn't otherwise give you, so you butter them up with praise so they'll give it to you. That's a type of stealing. You can steal from God. You can steal from God. In the book of Matthew, there's a story of King Herod. It says he stole glory from God because he'd done something great, and people were like, man, that was great, and it was awesome. And rather than giving glory to God, he took it for himself. It says that God struck him dead, because he'd stolen glory that belongs to God. The book of Malachi in the Old Testament says that not tithing or not giving the first 10% of what God gives you back to him, that's a type of stealing. And you say, well, why is that stealing? I mean, it's my money. Why do I got to give it to him? I've told you before, you're thinking about it all wrong. It's not your money, it's God's money He gave to you. He put the breath in your body to be able to work a job. He put the soil under your feet so that you could have a place to live upon. He gave you the talents He gave you. I've described it like this. I'm like, it's, you know, say you had somebody that left you $10,000. Said, I'm going to leave this to you, but here's what the deal is. When I leave you this $10,000, I got one request. I want you to take $1,000 of that $10,000, and as the executor of my estate, I want you to give $1,000 out of the $10,000, 10%, I want you to give it to this charity that I really like. Yeah, now you look back at that person, and you're like, I cannot believe you, stingy, demanding person, demanding I give $1,000 to a charity. You're like, no, it's all my money. I'm giving you all 10,000 of it, so I have every right to tell you to take 10% of that and give it to something that I choose to. When God gives us what He gives us, He says, that first 10% is mine. And Malachi says, in no uncertain terms, no mince terms at all, Malachi 3:10, when you withhold that from God, you are robbing from Him. Paul says in Romans 1:14, or actually, let me get one more before I get to that one. The book of Proverbs, chapter 3, says that if you are rich and you do not use your riches to help others, you're stealing. Like, if you say, well, why is it stealing? It's my money. It's my money. I earned it. Proverbs says that God gave you what He gave you because He intended for you that have to be able to bless and empower those who do not have. Proverbs 3:27 and 28. It says that when you do not, when you spend it on yourself as if it's all about you, you are robbing the poor from what God gave you to be able to share with them. 2 Corinthians chapter 9 says the exact same thing. What that means is that God has given you money, which He has many of you, and you are not leveraging that money and that position to bless other people, you're robbing. College student, that means if you're talented and you've got a bright future ahead of you and you're only thinking about how to leverage that career to be able to bless yourself, you are robbing the world of what God gave you for their benefit. Paul in Romans 1:14 says that for him not to share the gospel with people who've never heard it is robbing them. Romans 1:14, he says, I'm a debtor to other nations. Basically, he explains it like this. He's like, you know what? I didn't deserve to be a Christian. It's not like God revealed Himself to me because I was smarter or more moral than anybody. God, in His grace and His love, chose me and revealed Himself to me. So, of course, because I received that unmerited grace, of course, it's my responsibility to take it to those who've never heard it. What's not fair, what is not fair is that those of us who know and believe and understand the gospel, who realize that God saved us when we didn't deserve it, for us to take that unspeakable gift and just be silent with it and to not leverage our lives in a radical way to be able to take the gospel to people who never heard it, who are no less worthy of it than you or I was, that makes us a thief because we are stealing what God gave us to share with others. That's all included in this command, thou shalt not steal. Okay? Number two, why we steal. That's what is stealing. Number two, why we steal. Now, as I explained to you in the first week, the reason we break any of the commandments always goes back to the first one, idolatry. That's certainly the case with this one. The reason we steal something is almost always because it plays the role of a god in our lives. That's what idolatry, of course, means. Now, if you remember, a god is anything you feel like you have to have in life in order to be happy or secure. That's what a functional god is. Anything you feel like, I've got to have that to be happy and secure. I need it. That's what is behind breaking any of the commandments, most certainly stealing. For example, when you steal money, it's because you think money is essential to something you really need in life. You could not imagine life or being happy without it. So you're willing to steal it. I explained this on our first week. People look to money to do two different things in their lives that they really ought to look to God primarily to do. The first thing that people look to money to do that they ought to look to God to do first is they look to money for security. The other thing that they look to money for is significance. Here's how I explain that. For some people, let's do significance first. For some people, money is the path to the good life. They define the good life as nice cars, vacation homes, nice clothes, living on a golf course, being part of a country club, the ability to fly first class, taking great vacations. I mean, these people, money for them is significance and beauty and enjoyment in life. So these people, they get money and what do they do with it? They spend it. These are the spenders, right? There's another kind of person I explained to you who has a different kind of personality, but for them, money is security. These are the people who are always worried about what's going to happen in the future. So when they get money, the first thing they do is they drop it into a bank account because they're saving for that rainy day. They want a safety net. They want to be secure from any possible threat. And saved money is the key to that. So these people don't spend their money. What do they do with it? They save their money. These are the savers. And like I've told you before, these two people, in some strange, sick law in the universe, always get married to one another. Right? You know what I'm talking about? So that when you get in a marriage, you're like, you cannot fathom why and how your spouse spends money the way they do. And you get an extra $1,000 and one of the couples like, hey, we got to spend that. Right? That's a nicer cable package and I can finally get some clothes and we can finally get some of that furniture we need. And the other person is like, oh my gosh, no, we got to put that in the bank. Because what happens, you know, next year when things don't go as well and they get married to each other, right? And the irony is they both look at each other and hate the other way the other one looks at money. Right? So one person, you know, the person who loves to spend looks at the person who saves and is like, you're such a miser. You're grumpy. I don't like being with you. And the person who saves is like, I cannot believe how irresponsible you are. You're still in middle school. What's wrong with you? I always want to blow your money everywhere. But see, at the root, they're the exact same person. And that is, they're both idolaters. They both worship money. They both look to money to do what only God can do. All right, well, switch to non-monetary things we steal. Whenever you steal something, even if it's not money, it goes back to the same thing, idolatry. For example, when you steal credit that doesn't belong to you, it's because you crave the attention that that stolen credit gives to you. Right? I mean, let me give you an example from my own life. The other night, I had a fluke chance, to have dinner with a group of people that were just really, really high-powered. Let's just say that. I knew somebody who got me to be a part of this dinner. It was 18 couples. This is not small change. This is like the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield, CEO of Wachovia, and the CEO of Fidelity. We're all at my table, okay? And I'm a pastor, right? So we're all talking about what we do, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a pastor. You know, which doesn't quite carry the clout as some of those others. So at one point, the guy that's hosting the dinner, this small dinner, goes around and starts to introduce everybody and tell them, you know, where they're connected and what they're doing. So he's going through talking about all these unbelievable accomplishments these people at my table have, and he comes to me. And he's like, and so JD is a pastor, and to kind of beef up what, you know, so that I, you know, because you're looking at this table and you're like, one of these things doesn't belong, one of these things, not like that, you know. So he's got to kind of beef up me, and so he starts talking about the success of our church, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then he makes the statement, he says, and the Summit Church has its own TV station. I was like, what? That's on TV station. And of course, when he said that, everybody around the table looked at me and was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I was like, yeah, yeah, TV station. And after he moved on, I was trying to think, how did he get that? What? And then I realized that he misunderstood this whole multi-site concept. That when I told them that we have a campus, we broadcast to other campuses from, he's like, oh, they have their own TV station that congregations from around the world tune into. But suddenly I became like more important in everybody's eyes because, you know, CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield. Yeah. But you guys got your own TV station? Nah. All right. One day you'll get there and you'll be up where I am with our own TV station. But in that minute, see, in that moment, I'm enjoying that stolen credit just for a little bit because I crave the attention and the status elevation that that stolen credit gives to me. You get the point? We steal because something plays the role of a God in our life. We crave something and we feel like we could not live without it. We couldn't be happy without it, so we steal it. You get this? This is so important. Stealing ultimately goes back to the fact that most of us are deeply dissatisfied people. We're not content with our position in life. So we want more money. We want more power. We want more honor. We wish we were more talented than we were. We want more emotional fulfillment. We wish we were in a better marriage. We want more sex. Whatever. We're not happy with our position in life, and so we steal to change that position in our lives. The drive for consumption. We are driven by consumption because we're not satisfied in God. Because we're egregious violators of the first commandment, and God is not our God and our refuge. That's why we break this commandment. All right? Number three, how we change. How we change. Like I told you at the beginning, the best way that I figured to show you how this change happens is just to tell you the story of somebody in the Bible who went from being the worst kind of thief imaginable to being one of the most generous people in the world. This is the New Testament's version of the Les Mis play, if you've ever seen that or seen the movie. All right, Les Mis. This is Jean Valjean you're about to meet in the New Testament. All right, Luke chapter 19, verse 1. If you have your Bible and you want to go there, we're going to spend the rest of our time here in the 10 verses that open the 19th chapter of Luke. Luke 19, verse 1. I'll put it on the screen here for you too. As Jesus entered Jericho, there was a man named Zacchaeus, and he was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. Verse 3, and he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was small of stature. He was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he, right, if you grew up in Sunday school. So he ran ahead and climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. Verse 5, and when Jesus came to the place, he looked up at him and he said to him, Zacchaeus, you come down, for I must stay at your house today. Verse 6, so he hurried and he came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled. And they said, He has gone in to be the guest of a man who's a sinner. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, look, the behalf of all my goods I give to the poor. And if I've defrauded anybody of anything, I restore it fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save the lost. A few key notes here about Zacchaeus, okay? First of all, he is the chief tax collector, or in Greek, the archetelonis, the chief over all the tax collectors. Now, if you were going to make a list today of the most popular jobs in America, IRS agent would probably not be near the top of that list, right? But in that day, we're talking about something way beyond an IRS agent. By the way, I read an article the other day that said that IRS agents are tired of the stigma that's attached to them saying, hi, I'm an IRS agent. And so they are trying to get it changed to tax code compliance director. And I'm like, yeah, that's a lot better, tax code compliance director. But in that day, this is way beyond a tax code compliance director. This is somebody, and no offense if you're an IRS agent. I like you. This is somebody who is a traitor and a thief. This is not just an annoying government official with little to no people skills when you talk to them on the phone. Not that I've had that experience. But this is not just that kind of person. This is somebody who is a traitor and a thief. You see, the Romans had a pretty ingenious system. And that is, when the Romans would take over a city like Jericho or Jerusalem, they would tax it so they could exploit the wealth and take it into the leading citizens and the emperor in Rome. But they figured out that if they transplanted a Roman official and put them in that city, the Roman official would never be able to get at all the wealth in the city, because he just simply would not know where it was, right? Because there's all these things that go on in the city he wouldn't know about. There'd be all these black markets, and he'd never really be able to get at the real wealth. So what the Romans came up with is, they're like, let's hire somebody from the city who knows the city really well, so they can know where the wealth is and they can get it for us. So that's what Zacchaeus is he is that guy who has been hired to get all that money. And they told him this. They said, look, you got to give us our share, but anything beyond what you get from these people that you don't owe to us, you can just keep from yourself. And here's a Roman army to help you. Here's a bunch of Roman soldiers to help you enforce that. That's who Zacchaeus is he is that guy. He is a tax collector who has grown unbelievably wealthy, extracting money from the people that he grew up with, from the people that were his neighbors, from his own family members, and using Roman soldiers to enforce it. And Roman soldiers would beat and rape and pillage and murder these Jewish citizens. And Zacchaeus is watching all this happen. He is that guy. Can you imagine a worse person? This is a thief who makes himself rich by exploiting his friends. The Jewish Mishnah, which is a collection of traditions from the first century, said that a tax collector was so low that they should not even be considered people. It says that you are free to lie to a tax collector, because lying to animals is not a sin. That's literally what it says. Like, you can lie to a dog. There's nothing sinful about lying to a dog. You can also lie to a tax collector, because lying to a tax collector is not a person, therefore it's not sin. That's Zacchaeus. And by the way, Jericho was the richest city in Israel, because it was on a trade route. And Zacchaeus was the chief over all the tax collectors in that city. So in other words, this is likely the wealthiest and possibly the most corrupt government official in the New Testament. Here's the thing to understand about Zacchaeus. Listen to this. Well, I told you all that. when you choose to become a tax collector, when you chose in that day to become a tax collector, you realized that you were choosing to alienate yourself from just about every relationship you had ever had. What does that mean? That means that a tax collector became a tax collector because they wanted money so badly that they were willing to sacrifice everything. Their society, their family, their integrity, their reputation, everything to get money. See, there's a little almost humorous detail in there. It says he has to climb a sycamore tree to see Jesus. Now, why does he have to do that? You say, well, because he's short, right? But that's not really, I mean, you know, when you're in a crowd and somebody that's short wants to stand in front of you, you let them stand in front of you, right? I mean, you know, Carl Scott, my friend, when we're at the UNC game, he wants to stand in front of me. I'm like, stand in front of me. Why? Because he doesn't obstruct my vision at all. He's a wee little man, right? I asked him if I could pick on him. He says, look, I'm too old to care about people picking on me anymore, so go right ahead. He's not climbing a sycamore tree because he's short. He's climbing a sycamore tree because all the people in the crowd are like, no, you disgusting pig, you wee little bad man. You are not going to get in front of us. You don't belong in this crowd. So he's got to climb that sycamore tree because he's totally outcast from society. By the way, can I throw something in here? This is totally off subject, but I think it's really important. You realize, I'm saying this, I want to say this to those of you who are here, and the biggest problem that you are having in learning about Jesus is because of some of Jesus' followers, because they're hypocritical and they really bother you. That's like the number one reason why people a lot of times won't become Christians, is because those of us who call ourselves his followers. Zacchaeus, in order to be able to really see Jesus, had to be willing to get beyond Jesus' self-righteous, hypocritical, judgmental admirers. And he has to climb a tree to get above them to be able to get a clear view of Jesus. And I think that's a great picture of what some of you need to do. Right? I realize that there's a lot of us who are very messed up. We're people, we're sinners just like you. And maybe what you need to do is climb up that tree a little bit and get a picture of Jesus and not have it obstructed by us. And Zacchaeus could be an encouragement to you that here's a guy who was not turned off by Jesus' followers, but knew there was something behind them that he wanted to get at. Okay? Totally off subject, but that was free. All right. Second thing that I want you to notice about Zacchaeus is I want you to notice why he's coming to Jesus. Why he's coming to Jesus. Namely, I want you to notice that he's not in a financial crisis. There's no indication that he's in financial ruin or that he's been diagnosed with cancer or even that his wife has left him. No indication of that at all. In fact, at the end of the story, we know he's still unbelievably wealthy because he gives away four times whatever he's stolen and half his goods back to the poor, so we know he still has a ton of money. There's no crisis in his life. The reason I say that is because a lot of times skeptics think that the only time people come to Jesus is in a time of crisis. That's not Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is coming to Jesus because he's intellectually open. And he has seen something about Jesus that is blowing his mind. But let me say something. And I don't want to be misunderstood, but I think I probably will be, but I'm going to say it anyway. All right? In my professional opinion, I'm a professional Christian. Okay, so this is the one place I get to be a professional. In my professional pastoral opinion, crisis is not usually the best time to seek God. I'm not saying that in a crisis you shouldn't seek God. Okay, don't hear that. I'm just saying that in a crisis, that's not usually the best time to seek God. You see, in a crisis, you're usually pretty desperate. You're not thinking clearly. Honestly, you're kind of gullible. You'll grab a hold of anything that you feel like can get you out of the mess you're in. So a lot of times you end up in a crisis seeking Jesus for what he can do for you, not for who he is in himself. And so when you get out of the crisis, you go on about your way because you were only using Jesus to get you out of the crisis. See, in my experience, crisis conversions often don't last long because as soon as you get back on your feet, you're back to the place where you were before you felt like you needed Jesus. So you don't need Jesus anymore. If there is a crisis in Zacchaeus' life, the crisis is this. He realizes that what he's given his life to is not going to satisfy or save him. Zacchaeus had lived a life of materialism. He lived a life of cheating and exploitation because he thought money was the way to happiness and security. But now he has seen that there is something more to life and that his money won't save him in death. This is not really what you would usually call a crisis. If anything, it's a crisis of realizing that he's built his whole life on something worthless. You follow what I'm saying there? I'm not saying that when you're in a crisis, you shouldn't seek God. Do not walk away from this and say, Pastor JD said, I'm in a crisis. I can't seek God. Got to wait till I get out of the crisis, then I can come to... No, I'm just saying, if you're in a crisis, you need to make sure that the reason you're seeking God is because of who He is in Himself and not simply as some kind of tool to get you out of a jam so you can go on about your life. You've got to come to a place where you realize God is the only treasure, God is the only thing worth living for, and God is the only thing to build your life on. That's what Zacchaeus is doing. He's not seeking Jesus because of what Jesus can do for him financially, because Jesus can give him his best life now. Jesus, he is seeking Jesus because of who Jesus is, because Jesus is God, and because Jesus is worth building your life on. Okay? That's why he's seeking Jesus. Third thing I want you to notice. I want you to notice how Jesus enters Zacchaeus' life. How he enters Zacchaeus' life. This is so beautiful. I love this. Verse 5. Jesus tells Zacchaeus that he's coming to his house to eat. He said, well, what's the big deal about that? I mean, it seems a little presumptuous. You know, just meet Jesus. Jesus is like coming to your house. Jesus is a little rude maybe, but, you know, Zacchaeus doesn't seem to mind. He's got plenty of money. Doesn't seem to bother him. He'll get his servants to fix food. What's the big deal? It's a big deal. Because, see, in that day, eating with somebody was a sign of intimate connection. It was a sign of fellowship. It was the closest possible social interaction that you could have with somebody. There is a scandalous order in this story. Verses 5 and 6, watch, Jesus eats with him. Verses 8 and 9, Zacchaeus changes his life. In other words, Jesus is eating with Zacchaeus before he changes. And in fact, it is the fact that Jesus is eating with him that is the reason why he changes. So that's why verse 7, the Jewish leaders are like, what's he doing? He's a guest of somebody who's a sinner. If Jesus had eaten with him after he'd cleaned up his life, verses 8 and 9, they wouldn't have thought anything about that. There's a scandalous order to the story. But watch this. This is so good. Jesus is showing Zacchaeus the difference between gospel and religion. Jesus said, Zacchaeus, salvation has come to your house before you change. In fact, the fact that salvation has come to your house is why you're going to change. Listen to me. Every other religion in the world would have said to Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus, there's only one way to God. There's only one way to salvation. Here it is. Clean up your life. Now go and do that, Zacchaeus. Go find salvation. Jesus said, no, Zacchaeus, salvation has come to you. And in response to salvation coming to you, Zacchaeus, you're going to change. Which leads to the fourth thing. And that is the change that comes in Zacchaeus' life. Y'all, it was a massive change. Verse 8 says that he volunteered to give back to people four times whatever he'd stolen from them. You know, the law in Israel, Leviticus, if you stole something from somebody, you pay it back to them and add like 20%. That's what was the usual penalty, right? The only time that you had to pay back four times is if you stole a cow. Don't ask why, okay? I don't know, but if you stole a cow, you had to pay back four times. Maybe it left the person in utter ruin. I don't know, okay? But, you know, that was free. I came up with that myself. The only time you had to pay back four times was if you stole a cow. Zacchaeus didn't need to pay back four times. He only needs to pay back one time plus 20%. Why is he doing it? Not because he has to, but because he wants to. Then there's that whole 50% thing. Giving away 50% to the poor. That was just gravy on top of everything. In fact, there's a little thing in the Greek language that you might miss. Because in our English translation, the ESV, it says that, behold, Lord, which is very formal sounding. In Greek, it's a very kind of playful word that just means look. Look! There's an eagerness. There's a joy. He's not like, oh, sovereign king, look at what I am doing that I hope that you will accept. He's like, look, Dad. Look! Look what I'm doing! There's this overflowing joy and delight in what he's given away. It's just pure flowing out of his heart. What has happened to Zacchaeus? What happened? Money no longer has a hold on him. That's what's happened. He's found a greater treasure, Jesus. And in experiencing Jesus' greater glory, greater grace, Zacchaeus is set free from his love of money. Remember, Zacchaeus was in a tree because he was a wee little despised bad man. That's why he was up in that tree. And we learned it rightfully so, that Jesus did not treat him with the scorn and reject he deserved. And no, Jesus paid him one of the highest social compliments, one of the highest expressions of acceptance and intimacy. He came and ate with him. And what's more, in the larger context of the book of Luke, there's some irony in all this. Because from the Gospel of Luke, we learn that Jesus was going to die on a tree. And the Jewish people all had this understanding that they knew, Deuteronomy 21, 23, cursed is everyone who dies on a tree. Jesus is going to die on a tree, despised in Zacchaeus' place. Zacchaeus deserved to be despised in a tree, but Jesus told him to come down into fellowship. Then Jesus, who deserved acceptance and fellowship, was strung up on a tree and despised. Jesus received the curse and the scorn and the shame that Zacchaeus deserved and gave Zacchaeus the love and acceptance that he had earned. In other words, Jesus traded places with Zacchaeus. That's the gospel. And when Zacchaeus sees that and he tastes it, it changes him from a man of greedy exploitation to a man of lavish generosity. Money lost his hold on Zacchaeus through the power of the gospel. So when and where and how does the thief's heart change? How do you go from being a wee little bad man to being a person of lavish generosity? How do you do that? By embracing the grace of Jesus, which has already embraced you. That's how. You see, maybe you steal because you feel like you have to have money to be secure in the future. Maybe that's why. Or maybe that's just why you can't be generous. You're like, well, you know, I got to have money. If I don't have money, who's going to take care of me in the future? So I can't give it all away. I got to have more of it, if anything. The only way that your wee little stingy, fearful heart will change is by looking at the cross. The God who rescued you, the God who gave himself for you when you were his enemy, will he not take care of you the rest of your life? Can you not depend on him? How could you possibly think that money is more security than what Jesus himself would give you? This is something I deal with. I told you about those two personality types. I'm definitely the saver. That's definitely my personality. Save it. Right? I'm not saying Veronica's the spender, but you do the math, okay? But, you know, that's, I'm a saver. And so recently just been thinking about the future, and I'm like, oh, well, my kid's got to go to college, and I want to make sure I can retire well, and I want to make sure I can do these things. And I just get worried. I get worried. Is it all going to add up? Now think about Jesus, Matthew 6. He says, you know, don't worry. Why would you worry? Your Heavenly Father knows you have need of these things. Well, Jesus, how do I know the Heavenly Father will take care of me? He sent me to die on a cross for you, and he was actually me, and he was dying for you. So don't you think that if he died for you when you were his enemy, don't you think he'll take care of you? Why would you ask that? I quote to myself Philippians 4 a lot of times, Philippians 4, 6. Don't be anxious about anything. Don't be anxious about anything. Don't be anxious about your kids growing up or retiring. Don't be anxious about where you're going to live. How are you going to pay your bills? Don't be anxious. That's a command. Why? Just make everything that you need known to God. God will be your security. Now, I'm not saying you don't save money. Okay, of course not. I'm just saying that you don't save money. You don't save money because it's your security. At the end of the day, you're not really dependent on the money. You're dependent on Jesus. If Jesus has given you the ability to save right now, you do that. But realize that he's the one that holds tomorrow, and you're not dependent on your bank account for it, which will mean that you don't save extravagantly. It means you will save sufficiently, and you will give extravagantly. That's what that means. Because you're no longer held by money as your security. Others of you, the reason that you steal or the reason you're not generous is because you feel like you need to raise your standard of living pretty significantly in order to be happy. Again, happiness for you is a better cable package, a member at a nicer club. You know, are you one of those people who always feels like the good life is about $20,000 more than whatever you're making right now? Is that you? Again, what do I say to you? How do I release you from that captivity? Look at the cross. That's how I do it. The God who poured himself out for you is the God that you possess. He is the God whose plan you get to be a part of. Let that kingdom become your beauty. Listen, in Jesus, I get to be a part of a kingdom of eternal value that lasts forever. I get to be a part of seeing lost people come to Jesus. I get to be a part of seeing poor people lifted out of poverty and empowered and brought to Jesus. I get to be a part of seeing orphans brought into families who will teach them to know and love Jesus. There is more beauty in those things than there is in anything that I could purchase with money. And if Jesus has become my beauty, then what I find is that I'm not compelled to give. I love to give because that is a greater beauty to me than are the things that money could have bought. Did that make sense? Right? In fact, let me tell you another article I read this week. I had a lot of good articles. I read this thing that talked about how stealing is such a rush for people. People that end up, like, you think about it, like every Hollywood heist movie, you just see the rush of the stealing. And they said there's even this bond that goes between people when they steal together. Some kind of unexplainable bond that goes from all the dopamines being released while they're robbing the bank. That's like the gist of every Hollywood Heist movie is a guy and girl rob something together and they're, you know, lovers for life. Right? That's why I love what Paul said. He didn't just say, don't quit stealing. He didn't say, just quit stealing. He said, start being a person of lavish generosity, because you think it was a rush to steal? Where do you get the rush of giving? Here's the problem with many of you and me. The problem is not that you steal all the time, and you're decently moral people. The problem is you're not people of generosity. You're boring. I almost want to tell you, just choose one or the other. Either steal or give away generously. It's just this middle part that's so disgusting and so boring and so middle class. Just do one or the other. Quit living a boring life. Either go into doing bank jobs or start giving it away. Because you're going to find that there's so much more beauty, so much more in Jesus and His kingdom than you can get with money. That's what Zacchaeus is on. He's on this adventure. He's on a rush. He's giddy. Maybe you don't give away money because the poverty in the world or the fact that so many people don't know Jesus doesn't move you. Again, look at the cross. Where would you be without Jesus? Where? The exact same place people are who don't know Jesus without you. You and I are their means for coming to know Jesus. How can we look at that and not be moved? See? 8,000 people born last week with AIDS. Why were they born with AIDS and not you? Because you're better? Because you're more moral? No! You don't deserve what you have. So then it means that those of us who were born into privilege, whether that's a privilege of possessions or it's a privilege of the knowledge of the gospel, we yield our lives so that those who are born without those things, because they're not any different than we are, they're not any worse than we are, we're not any better, we yield our lives to be able to see things come to them. 6,500 unreached people groups in the world, which means a people group that doesn't have a witness to the gospel. Why were you born in a place where you could come to a church like this one and hear the gospel? Is it because you were better? Is it because God looked through history and said, that person deserves a chance to hear the gospel? No. It was just grace. It was just grace. That's all it was. So how could you possibly receive the unbelievably lavish grace of God and then not yield your life to take it to those who've never heard it? An old Scottish preacher, Robert Murray McShane, who said this, the more you understand who Jesus is and what He's done for you, the more generous you become. People are always asking me this question. They're always like, well, how much? How much? What's the amount? See, one thing I love about the Gospel of Luke, you've probably never seen this. This is great. Three major times, well, actually several, but I'm going to pick three of them, that the Gospel of Luke talks about giving. Right? One of them is here, and how much does Zacchaeus give away? 50%. Right? Another one where Jesus talks about giving is Luke 18, where the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, I want to follow you. And Jesus says, give away everything. 100%. So how much? We got 100%. We got 50%. Then in Luke 11, Jesus is talking to a group of religious people. And He's like, hey, you people tithe. That's great. So, okay, wait a minute. 100%, 50%, 10%. To all of them, Jesus says, that's awesome. Need a little consistency here, Jesus. Is it 10? Is it 50? Is it 100? Which one? And the point is, as long as you're asking that question, you don't understand the gospel. When you're asking the question, how much, you don't understand the gospel, because when you understand the gospel, the question is not, watch, how much do I have to give? The question is, how much do I get to give? Because if Jesus has become your security, you no longer need a ton of it to be secure. If Jesus has become your beauty, what else do you want to spend your money on besides the beauty of Jesus' kingdom? So you start asking, how much can I give? How much can I give? If you are not generous, you don't understand the gospel. If you feel guilty about how much money you give or don't give, you don't understand the gospel. Because the gospel is freedom. The gospel is experiencing the unbelievable treasure of who Jesus is, finding Him as your beauty, finding Him as your security, being so overwhelmed at His grace that you just start to say, I don't need all the nice stuff I used to have to make myself happy. I just don't need it that much anymore. I don't need all this money to be secure. I just want to give. And if you don't experience that, then you're not really in touch with the grace of God. That's why we have a little phrase around here. We say, live sufficiently, give extravagantly. What we mean by that is there's nothing wrong with the money God gave you. He gave it to you so you can take care of yourself. But it means that your heart begins to say, I got greater beauty and greater security, and I want to give. You follow what I'm getting at with that? Which leads me to the very last thing I'll say, and I'm going to be done. If you don't give at all, if you don't give generously, it goes back to the fact that you got a deep gospel problem. Really, I mean, Robert Murray McShane, a guy I quoted earlier, let me finish this quote to you. He says this, the more you understand who Jesus is and what he's done for you, the more generous you become. I fear there are many hearing me right now who know they are not Christians because they do not love to give largely and liberally, not grudging at all, because that requires a new heart. An old heart would rather part with its lifeblood than with its money. You have an old heart or a new heart? When I grew up, there was some Christians that I was a part of their circles where they always had a test. They had these tests for whether or not you were a true Christian. And it always revolved around the length of your hair, the kind of music you listened to, and whether or not you drank beer. And I look back on that now, and that's pretty ridiculous. But there are some signs about whether or not you know God and whether or not you experience the gospel. You know what they are? They're always, always, always in the Bible, generosity. If you know Jesus as beauty, security, treasure, if you know him as grace, you become generous. And if you don't know, if you're not generous, it means because you don't know it. How do you go from having the old heart to the new heart? Zacchaeus. Just receive the salvation that has come to your house. That's the gospel. I don't want you to walk away from here and say, I gotta go be more generous. I gotta go quit stealing. I want you to walk away from here and say, salvation has come to my house. It's knocking at your door. Jesus has done everything necessary to save you. But like Zacchaeus, you have to choose to let him in. You have to choose to let him come to your house. You embrace the gospel that has already embraced you. And when you embrace that, you'll find it transforms your entire heart and your entire life. Have you done that? Have you ever let salvation come into your house? Not what you do, it's what he's done. Why don't you bow your heads at all of our campuses and let me pray for us. If you've never received Jesus as your Savior, salvation is knocking at your door. It's come to your house. Have you ever just opened the door and said, Jesus, yes, I receive you. Let him have control of your life right now. Say, Jesus, you're the Lord. You can come in and take control. I receive what you've done for me. I don't know how the thief's heart changes to the heart of generosity. Jesus coming to the house. Father, make us gospel-centered, gospel-loving people. We're overwhelmed with your grace and your beauty. Give lavishly in response. I pray in Jesus' name.